are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
On the Elephant in the Room podcast this week, I speak with Laura Osborne and Alison Goldsworthy, two of the three authors of the book Poles Apart, Why People Turn Against Each Other. In Poles Apart, an expert on polarization, a behavioral scientist and a professional communicator explain why we are so prone to be drawn into rival and often deeply antagonistic factions.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you, Alison, for being a guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
I'll just get started with the questions. So you've just written this book, Poles Apart, and three of you have written it together. How did the collaboration between the three of you come about? I'd read that you set up the Change Your Mind podcast, and it was the conversations with the guests combined with Ali's experience at Stanford that led you to write the book. Is this true?
Yeah, that is in essence true. So Alex, our co-author, and then Laura, who's on the podcast with me today, and myself, we all used to work at the Consumers Association in the UK. We just really enjoyed working with each other and really respected each other's knowledge and talents because we were good at things that the other person wasn't in general. And then I went out to Stanford, and that was just in the year 2016. So Brexit had happened, Trump was going on, and I realized that the way that we worked from different political backgrounds and reaching across divides was really very unusual, particularly that we all enjoyed it. And then what really tripped me onto it was I was sat in a room at Stanford. We helped put on a course on depolarization in the aftermath of the election. And an audience member asked some people who'd voted for Trump who were on a panel, can you tell me about a time you've changed your mind and why? And you could feel the entire sort of tenor of the room change as people answer that question. So Kat, who's a friend who voted for Trump, talked about how she had been raised as a Roman Catholic to believe all gay marriage was wrong, and then had gone to college or uni and had a roommate who was a lesbian and was really ashamed of her prior beliefs and couldn't believe she thought it and all of that kind of thing. And when she said that, the amount of people who softened was significant because they could see that engaging was worthwhile. And I was telling this story to Laura and Alex, and it began to morph into a podcast that we should ask people with our backgrounds from politics and business and behaviour science about a time they changed their mind and why. And Open Democracy leapt at the idea. They absolutely leapt at it. And as a result, we went from there to then getting a book deal. And quite unusually, you hear tales of people collaborating as authors and really not getting on. And the three of us are closer now than we were when we were at Which. I was talking to Laura the other day and saying, can we have this as a monthly supper club for the rest of our life? Because it's so much fun. And I get so much wisdom from these two women that it's really valuable. So I guess that's how the book came about. Laura might want to expand and answer the bit of the question I didn't about like what the essence of Poles Apart is.
So thanks, Ali. And I think that's absolutely right. We were, I think, really pleasantly surprised about how we managed to work together all the way through this in a way that was really constructive and where we all made each other better at what we do. And I think when we started to write the book, what we really wanted to do, and it might sound a bit hackneyed, was something that was quite solutions focused. So I think there's a lot of work on polarization, you know, excellent work on why it is such a difficult issue for society to grapple with. Not so much of it that's written in a way that a wide audience can interact with it, and perhaps not so much of it that's written in a way that has a big focus on what you can do about it in your lives, you know, accepting that there are these kind of system level issues, what each of us can do to make a difference everywhere we interact with it. So I think for us, the real premise behind the book was, what can you do to bridge those divides? Not just accepting that they exist, but what might we all do about it?
It's amazing. So what is the essential premise behind the book? A bit of what you explained, that it's solutions driven and you're looking at what can bridge the divide between different kinds of thinking.
So if I pick up a bit there, and Ali, I might hand back to you as well. I think the central premise behind it, Suda, was that the divides can be bridged, but it's not easy. you know, that there is not one quick, easy silver bullet for all of the divisions that we see around us, that it's a complex phenomenon, but that we can break it down. And that actually, when we do that, each of us individually can start to pick some of our beliefs apart, and especially our beliefs about other people and about other groups. And that we can learn a lot about how we try to persuade other people, you know, what we should really do if we genuinely want to have a conversation rather than an argument about something, you know, the tools that can be applied to that. I think a bit for us as communicators as well, reflecting on where we might have in the past inadvertently made some of that worse. You know, Ali, I don't know if you want to talk a bit about your campaigning experience there, but I think, you know, it was understanding where some of the divisions that you might deliberately create can backfire, become problematic.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of exactly what Laura said. So I made my name as a troublemaker, a rabble rouser, you know, at which I built a base of millions of people who I could get to take an action almost whenever I asked them to do. And as I realized, sometimes some of those actions and things like from emailing your MP to sharing something on social media to signing friends up, you know, some of them were extremely worthwhile. Occasionally I might, and comms professionals who listeners might have known, it was a slightly weaker request that I was making, but I would still see hundreds of thousands of people doing it. And that was great. It made me feel really powerful. And I thought we were bringing about change, and often we were. And then when Trump started to happen and when Brexit happened, I realized that maybe I hadn't always been as responsible as I should have been, or that people could build these huge movements, which is much easier in 2021 than it was 100 years ago because of tech. And none of us ever really thought about, were we creating any damage with what we were doing? And the answer was that we probably were. And that also started me thinking, because I was a bit inclined to be like, oh God, these people, all these other people, it's everybody else's fault. And then I was like, actually, it's a bit my fault. In fact, the more I've thought about it, it was really quite a lot my fault, what was going on. And if you don't all or have a really good critical mass of people respecting norms and rules of engagement, then things actually start to fray quite quickly, as people are seeing, as polarization is rising in general around the world, where you are in India, where Laura is in London, and where I am in the US, are all places where polarization is rising to very dangerous levels.
Absolutely. And that brings us very neatly into the next question about, what does effective polarization mean?
So I think often when you think about polarization, we think quite narrowly about our views on particular issues. And I think the question historically, when talking about it, it's been focused very much on how far apart those views are. But actually, as Ali touched on, talking about those groups that were being created before, identity is also a really important part of that. And those issue-based differences quite quickly become differences of social identity. And when that happens, there's obviously a kind of feelings more than facts aspect of that. And people increasingly dislike and distrust those from opposing sides, irrespective of whether they actually disagree on a specific issue. And once we group in that way, those kind of labels that we adopt for the us and them groups come to act as proxies for all kinds of differences in beliefs and values and behavior that actually go far beyond the groups themselves. And it's this that's known as effective polarization. So it's that sense that it's moved into identity, it's very much moved into us and them, and the us and them don't actually really have to disagree on very much, but there can still be very significant divisions.
That explains a lot. We're very interested to hear this. So how does misinformation exacerbate existing differences? And since all of us have been working in this area in communications, campaigning, and a lot of times I think we are also responsible for some of the not so correct communications that is happening, which may be misinformation also.
Yeah, so it's a big question, isn't it? And I think I'll maybe answer it in two parts, which, you know, the first is, given that how effective polarization operates, it's not particularly difficult, as Ali said, to activate those divides. They are very emotional. They are much more present and palpable when we're in times of uncertainty or when we feel under threat. So, you know, the sort of perfect storm of a pandemic and economic uncertainty. There's lots of things that make people vulnerable to the activation of those groupish divisions. And I think what misinformation does is both obviously mislead people to think in some cases, you know, the divides are more explicit and worse than they are, but in others, it worsens that sense. And so, you know, we know people respond much more strongly to negative news, to bad news, and that it will trigger certain responses. And a lot of what that does is just reinforce those group identities. So there are real kind of risks there. I know, Ali, you did some really good work on fake news for the book. I don't know if you want to give a couple of examples there.
On fake news, which is one, it's really hard to update a position once you've taken it and once you've taken it publicly, which is one of the challenges of misinformation, is often it's designed to be particularly triggering and not always by terribly genuine actors who want to do things. So one of the classic examples is, you know, foreign interference in elections. They could have a preferred candidate. And people often think nowadays in terms of a guy called Surkov, who's not quite as influential as he was, but yeah. In Russia, and how he deliberately would fund extremes to yeah. try and get sort of misinformation out there. There's some evidence that that happened in Scotland and certainly in the US. So that's one of the problems with misinformation. Another thing actually is people, they don't want to fall for misinformation. People find it really hard to believe that they have fallen for it, and they particularly find it hard to believe people like them will fall for it, but that people from the other group, all of them, I never fall for misinformation. It's all those other stupid people yeah. from that other group that all fall for it. Almost all of us will fall for it in some way at some point. And it can be a bit embarrassing when you do, because no, everyone like to think that it doesn't affect us, and it does. And that's one of the really big ways that it plays into polarization and can be very challenging, and how it can amplify our existing beliefs. And suddenly you can end up down a spiral holding on to something very suddenly, which is really tricky to undo. There are some ways that Laura's talked a lot about solutions that you can help to reduce the effect of misinformation, which is one, partly to become better at spotting it and falling for it. So there's a very neat game that some guys at Cambridge Uni did called the Bad News Quiz, which asks people to go through and try and spot fake news in a sort of funny and humorous way. And it sort of gets you to try and spot which might be a fake account or where a message might have been taken over by someone else. And what's really neat about this game is that, one, it acts as an inoculation against you doing it, so you start to get better at spotting things in the future, but also the role of humour that they play in it. And if you're able to laugh at yourself or find something funny, it's much easier to detach yourself from your prior belief and to generate a bit of empathy either for yourself or for others and go from there. And so that's how it goes with misinformation. Of course, the concept of misinformation itself, or disinformation, both of them slightly different things, but they're not new either. Again, they've been used for a very long time for often nefarious purposes, let's put it that way.
Absolutely. I can see so much of what we do in our daily lives, you know, when we take positions. I mean, even us, even me, you know, if I've taken a position on something because I believe in it, we all find it difficult to back down from that position, even if we can see far away on the horizon that it may not be quite right.
Yeah, and that's why this question about asking people about a time they changed their mind is so important, right? And because people find it so hard to remember a time that they've done so, or that they might have been taken in by misinformation yeah. or something yeah. like that. Because this is slightly simplifying it, but it activates the same parts of your brain that can feel pain almost. And so that it can be physically painful almost to admit that you got things wrong and to change your mind if you're not very careful about things. And then also we're quite programmed to forget when we do it, because we don't like to hold that dissonance in our heads. And that can be very challenging for people as individuals and for leaders and for how we engage with them.
Alison, I really liked hearing the thing about pain, that it activates that part. So I know yeah. why I'm not going to be changing my stance. A lot of things I do with my kids.
I have to say, children are a great bonder across divides. So one of the things we might come on to talk about in a second is, you know, how do you try and solve things people you might disagree with? And one of them is to find out something you have in common with them that you don't otherwise, and talk about that first. So you kind of yeah. fool your brain into thinking you share a group, and kids and motherhood. And suddenly you bond across divides, and it can be really powerful. Yeah. So yes, big up for the kids. They're not necessarily at 3 a.m. when they're keeping me up.
No, really good example. I think everybody will be able to identify with those. So in the book, you've explored how our genetic makeup shapes our fundamental views and the influence of family, friends, and peers on the same. I'd like to hear more about it.
Thank you. So I'll kick off, and I'll bring Ali in a second, I'm sure. But I think probably the first key thing to say with the work on genetics is that there is no specific gene that exists for a particular political leaning, you know, socialism or conservatism or liberalism. It doesn't really work like like that. But what our genes do is dictate our sensitivity to things. And so our genetic makeup and the way it interacts with our environments does shape the way that we both perceive the world and respond to it. So there is some really interesting work, as you mentioned there, Sudha, about epigenetics and how all of those processes work together. And I think one thing that really stuck with me was the role of our regulator genes in this process. So for those who don't know much about genetics, which included me before we did the book, the differences in our structural genes are what explains the differences in how we look, and the difference in our regulator genes partially explain the differences in how we behave. So it's really the way that the two of them interact. And so the interaction of those genes can influence how we respond to the environment around us. And obviously all of this stuff comes from when we were living as prehistoric, you know, creatures trying to survive in the wild and forming groups. And a lot of this stems back from those kind of early days of humanity, but it does help to explain some of why we can be more or less prone to engaging in different types of groups, why we can be more or less sort of small c conservative, and how that interacts with our environment. And I think if Alex, our co-author, were here, that's the other point she would probably make, is that how critical that wider environment is in terms of those interactions, because what you experience and how you are raised and the people that you grow up around, they will all shape some of how you think. And there's a really interesting statistic actually on how increasingly focused we are on wanting our children to marry people who have a similar political outlook to ourselves. So 30 years ago, only 5% of Americans cared whether their child married someone of a different political, maybe difficult is the one, different political persuasion. But today that's nearly half, and about a third of Democrats who say they'd be actively displeased if their child married outside the sort of preferred political party, which I think shows you how strong some of these kind of political partisan in-groups are becoming. Ali, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I think this was one of the bits of the book that, as we were researching it, made me more uncomfortable, if I'm honest. And I just had to learn to live with that discomfort, because I very much wanted to be like, of course I'm in charge of my own views. My genetics isn't shaped by politics. You know, jog on. I'm my own woman. I'm really independent. And actually, all the evidence is that that's not the case. It's an interaction, as Laura said, of the environment and the genes that you have. And one of the example that we use in the book, are sort of a classic one, though, a slightly more extreme one, is if any of your listeners have seen the film Free Solo, which is about a guy called Alex Honnold, who's a climber, and he climbed El Capitan, which is a 3,000 foot or 1,000 meter-ish climb in a slab of granite rock in Yosemite National Park here without ropes. He just went straight up it. And it's an astonishingly brilliant film. But Alex doesn't have a normal response to risk, as you might imagine, in that thing, a bit of the brain called the amygdala. For him, it just doesn't really activate from the environment. But the amygdala, which, you know, is like, oh, I'm feeling a bit threatened by this, or I want to try and conserve things or do things differently. That can be activated very differently in different people. And of course, then, if you're more conservative and you feel more threatened, the clue's in the name, you also tend to vote more conservative and go from that. And that will interact with your viewpoint. And that makes perfect sense to me. But is also, as I say, slightly uncomfortable for someone who had previously been like, no, free will's how we do things. What it is that you might be someone who is naturally more inclined maybe to collaborate or to, like I say, to respond to risk and to threat differently. And you can see that in children or in other people and in the differences in how they behave already.
This is really very interesting. I've been running these sessions on unconscious bias. The people around you, I think they influence a lot of those behaviors ultimately. And none of us are pure in that thinking that, you know, this is our very own thought.
No, we like to think we are, but we definitely aren't.
No. And the thing is anyone that tells you that they're immune from it, you should be wildly suspicious of.
Moving on to the next question. We live in an increasingly fragile and polarized world, and people on both sides of the divide are unwilling to move or be open. How does a desire to reduce uncertainty play into existing divisions?
Oh, well, that's a great question. So uncertainty can generally, it's not always the case, but uncertainty generally amplifies divides. And if people think about it as, you know, you're not certain of something, you probably look for some reassurance. And you might look for reassurance from people who are going to tell you nice things about yourself, because that makes you feel better. And those people tend to come from the same political viewpoints as you. And if you're already a bit polarized and hanging out with people who share similar political tribes, that increases. So uncertainty then reinforces that. And you can see how you get into quite a spiral quite quickly with what's going on. And given the context of the world in 2021, with what COVID has done, you know, that is inherently uncertain, just working out everything from what a government response is to exactly how the disease was formed or what it might impact on your family or on your business, or all of those things are very uncertain and unsettling for people. Then one of the other things that amplifies polarization that often is allied with uncertainty is gaps between rich and poor widening, and to a certain extent unemployment too. And whatever hue a government is, almost all of them around the world have had to borrow unspeakably large amounts of money as they've in effect nationalized economies in the last 18 months. And paying that back, whatever decisions they take about it, is almost certainly going to involve some cuts and some difficulty for people. And that's going to, again, amplify polarization. And there is uncertainty about what those decisions will be and how people will turn out things. And it might actually get quite a bit worse in a few places, because the things that you can do to bridge divides and reduce it are also much harder in a time of COVID and where lots of people are isolating or spending time on their own or not interacting face to face with people. These are all for a week or two, it doesn't matter. But long run, they have really quite big consequences on our groupish and tribal tendencies, which are not great.
Laura, would you like to add anything to that?
Ali's captured it well there. And I think the key thing is she says that when we're uncertain, we want to lean into things that make us feel more certain. And that's where that group identity comes in. It's where we feel like we belong. It really reassures us. It makes us feel like navigating an uncertain and, you know, difficult world is going to be that much easier. But, you know, the kind of push towards those identities, it can have downsides too. And there's a really interesting study in the book by three German academics around the impact of financial crashes on people's politics and which way it makes them pull. And the really interesting thing about that is every financial crash over the last 200 years has led to a more pronounced leaning to more extreme parties. And actually interesting, that's not just the right, rather sometimes it's the left. But what it does do is it does push us further into those identities, and politically it can push people further to the extreme. So the point that Ali makes around what happens when all the money from COVID has to be paid back, you know, that's a point at which we have to be really conscious of what our natures and our groupish identities might push us towards. And, you know, you asked at the beginning, what was the premise for the book? And really, it was sort of sharing that awareness that actually, this is how we all behave. We're all part of the problem, and we often don't recognize it in ourselves. But if we don't recognize it in ourselves, how are we going to see it anywhere else?
That's so true. So what is the role of social media in driving deeper divisions in society? And this is something that has been discussed so much. We know about the divisions that they've been exacerbating, but how does it play out in the sense that we are talking about polarization? Social media can also be something that can bring people together.
Yeah, so you're right, this has been much discussed, and I'm going to broaden your question as well in a second slightly, but the compromise of the effects of social media on polarization is that it mutes moderate voices, makes it harder for them to be seen, and it amplifies extreme voices, both of the group that you are in and the groups that you are not. And that has a few pretty tricky effects, which is, one, we all build up stereotypes, both of ourselves but of other groups, and it means those stereotypes become much more reflective of those extreme voices in outgroup. It's a concept called outgroup homogeneity. So we think all of those people who are from a different tribe are exactly the same as the loudest and the worst voices, and it stops us being able to see nuance. That is amplified because the more moderating voices are much less engaged with in the way that the algorithms are all set up, and so you hear even less of them. So it can be pretty toxic to what's going on in terms of polarization and divisions in society. And of course, there's things around the speed with which messages can flow now, and how things are shared are so much quicker than they used to be. And that can mean that it's much harder for us to have processes to do things. From a very regulatory point of view, there has been massive, I would say, global regulatory fail in terms of tech companies and regulating them in terms of the effect that they have on democracy. And even now, you'll see the debate, despite things like with what happened in Facebook in Myanmar, where it was linked to a genocide, basically, or even how information spread in the US or UK around Brexit. And even now, people will have a very backwards looking regulatory look. They will be like, oh my word, what went on? How do we prevent that happening again? Which is a good question to ask. But an even better question would be, what is this landscape going to be like in 10 years' time? And what are people who do jobs like I used to do, where they rabble rouse and they blur the boundaries and they see what they could get away with? What are they going to do that we need to try and regulate and safeguard against? And you see very little of that debate and discussion going on around social media. Given that this is a comms podcast, I'll just dwell on this point a bit, which is, we all like to have a baddie, and my word, Facebook in particular, makes itself a very good baddie because it does do a lot of idiotic things. But we miss a bunch of other channels by only focusing on Facebook. So probably there's not enough discussion about how Google does its search rankings and that it's really easy for unauthoritative sources to SEO and gain their way up to the top of a search list. Whereas somebody who responds sensibly and is measured and authoritative will often get downvoted and be gained out of it. That's not helpful. It helps misinformation and extreme views to spread and amplifies again those extreme voices and mutes the middle. There are other channels which are harder to see, which are much, much more powerful. So more money is raised by email or by text messaging, very often by political candidates, than is on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And yet there is absolutely nothing looking in terms of research at the effects of email. And that is direct. You don't even get to see it. It's really easy to program very individual journeys. You don't get to see it. You know, Donald Trump, he's off Facebook and Twitter. Okay, he built his lists on them. He'll be raising loads and loads and loads of money. And people think that he's not there, or he's not as a threat to democracy that he was because he hasn't got those platforms. You want to bet he's still got platforms. They just aren't the ones that journalists are monitoring. And that's a really big issue that is a massive gaping hole in terms of both research and scrutiny that goes on around comms and where people can misuse things. I can give other examples around how brand safety works, where people will inadvertently fuel polarization from tech. And so brand safety, in essence, is where people will say, I don't want my adverts appear, or this bit of brand safety, I don't want my adverts appearing next to a very negative news story. And it's something that lots of people in PR do. Certainly I've done it. I know Laura has done it. You think, gosh, there's a terrorist incident. I don't want an advert for my brand next to that. That won't make it look good. But what actually happens as a consequence of doing that is that you reduce any incentives for people to report on some of these very tricky but extremely newsworthy events, and instead encourage them to report on things that are very fluffy or quite bassy. And how that interacts with the newspaper industry can be really toxic for spreading reliable information. But there's a lot more to it. And I'll just round off by saying, clearly it's not all bad. Like Facebook and other things can connect people who wouldn't otherwise be connected. And during the pandemic, you've seen the flourishing of community groups where people have been able to help each other and connect in ways that they wouldn't otherwise have done so. And that's in the broader Facebook universe, so particularly including WhatsApp in that. And I'll take a second to let Laura see if she wants to add anything to one of my particular hobby horses.
I was just going to say, I think it's safe to say there's a lot going on behind closed doors or either closed email accounts.
Absolutely. This is not something that we can cover in one episode. I think we need several episodes to go through this. And of course, we must also consider the role of comms professionals and how they enable or are vigilant about these issues. So what is the potential impact on business and individuals of polarization? Do they recognize it as a risk? And how can they prepare for it or address it? I don't think 10 years ago, brands were considering polarization.
So I think the first thing to say probably, Suda, is no, people aren't thinking about it as much as they possibly should do or might want to in the years ahead. And part of what we did in the course of researching the book was have a conversation with a lot of different business people. We did a lot of research, and there are some quite, I guess, enlightened businesses who are thinking about it a lot, but they are the rarity. So, you know, for example, Spare Room think really carefully about how they advertise for people so that it doesn't force people into negative groups. It encourages people to positively talk about, we would like to live with someone who X rather than isn't Y. And, you know, they really do build that into their thinking. But for the most part, people don't. So we talked to quite a lot of people about whether they thought about how polarization might be affecting board makeups, how it might be influencing hiring processes, how it might shape innovation. And I think, as I say, there are outliers, but for the most part, people aren't thinking about it an enormous amount. And I think it's probably just a matter of time until that changes a bit. But, you know, we see the consequences of choosing to work with people who are just like us. And, you know, polarization, essentially, it's an extension of that behavior. So, you know, if we are running the risk of hiring people who belong to the same political groups, who have the same outlook as us, then clearly there are going to be questions for diversity, for innovation, and for bringing different voices into the business. And as we all know, one of the big issues there is also if you're explaining something to somebody who you already know thinks the same as you do, you don't have to try very hard to justify it. No. You don't, as Absolutely. Ali said, you don't go through that process of scrutinizing or justifying what you're doing. And, you know, I thought it was really interesting today, you know, the first report is out on the COVID response from the UK government. And one of the things that they were saying was a massive problem there was groupthink, was everybody in the room coming from roughly the same standpoint, roughly the same nation, you know, having the same broad outlook and therefore coming to the same conclusions. And I do think there is a risk for businesses in the context of polarization, effective polarization, particularly if it deepens, in essentially screening out people unknowingly, in many cases, based on their political views. And that could have significant issues on who gets hired. And so for individuals, that could make the difference between ultimately you getting a job or not.
Yeah, and it's really interesting what Laura says in terms of COVID response. I think it was New Zealand, I need to double check this, but where they actually pulled people from different political parties into a room and they worked together. And New Zealand clearly has other advantages in that it's an island a very long way from anywhere else that's used to being relatively self-sufficient. But they've had a much better COVID management system. And the UK, actually, it's an island. It had some advantages over others in how to handle a pandemic and what to do about it. And they squandered it. But the other interesting thing is there's not much, despite what is being branded today as, you know, one of the biggest public health failures in history about some of those decisions, there's almost no electoral penalty that the government has paid for its performance. Like almost none, because people are in their tribes and they find it really hard to update it. And there's other reasons about credible opposition and things. But, you know, that tribalism and how it's part of people's identity and unable to admit their own side's done something wrong or others would be better is definitely part of what is going on.
And it brings us back a bit to the challenges there for scrutiny, doesn't it? Because one of the big criticisms in the media, which I'm sure will play out more, is those parliamentary committees who are scrutinising this stuff after the moment are saying, actually, why didn't the UK, as I said, ask different countries, why do we have this kind of British exceptionalism view? Why is it that we've all stayed within our groups? And I think effective polarisation tells you quite a lot about why that is, actually, and also the downsides, which are very significant in that you're missing these whole chunk of views because you've embedded in your tribe essentially as the decision maker. But also there's a lack of accountability. You know, as Ali said, it's very difficult if you support the approach that a party has taken. And I don't want to just single out the government here. It could be the case if it was any of the leading political parties. If you belong to that party, it's very hard for you to go against the individual actions that they take because it feels very much like going against your group and going against your tribe. And clearly that's one of the big challenges here.
Yeah, I think that is increasingly the trend with whichever party. There is no accountability. You know, people do all sorts of things, personal or professional or as a government or as opposition, and they don't have to pay a price for it. And I guess that's another story altogether.
It's another podcast, yeah.
Yeah, that's another podcast. So consumers increasingly want to engage businesses that take a stand on issues that are important to them. And we've seen this in the last 18 months with the tragic killing that happened in the US and Black Lives Matter and then the pandemic. Those who tried to attach themselves to something without being really authentic were called out by consumers. So how can CEOs prepare for this sort of situation? Because it'll require balance and deeper understanding of the issues. And most of our leaders, they are technical people. Even when I talk about DEI, this is not something that MBA schools teach.
I actually think it's really hard for CEOs at the moment and leaders. I think this is a really difficult time, in part because, as you say, the issues that businesses, particularly their leaders, need to be prepared to take a stand on are much broader in lots of ways than they have been in the past. And the expectation is much greater that they'll do that. I mean, the flip side is also that there's a cost. So one of the really interesting pieces of research that we found in the book was essentially saying, yes, people will go and buy from or go and join a company where they think the CEO speaks for them, speaks on the issues they care about. But conversely, as you'd expect, around the same proportion won't go and work for that company if it goes the way that they disagree with. So I think there is a really difficult balance to be struck. And as you said, Sudha, it requires a really great level of understanding. I mean, I think there's probably a difference to be drawn. And this was something actually that came out in an event that we did not so long ago, an international one. One of the questions was, well, should CEOs do nothing? And I don't think doing nothing is an option for them. And, you know, we wouldn't advocate stepping back from social issues because I think business has a really important part to play in that. But I think the thing to do, as you say, is to be very mindful that taking a very strong stance might have costs, and there might be mitigation that you need to do alongside that, both with consumers potentially, but also perhaps more importantly with your staff body. I think particularly a relevant, you know, issue here is climate change. You know, as we move into a stage where everybody needs to change their behavior significantly, and if that starts to be an issue where businesses are telling their staff what they need to do, they need to be prepared to offer the help and support that will enable them to make those changes as well, rather than just telling people to do things. Because as we all know, when you just tell someone to do something, a lot of the time their reaction is not very positive. Whereas if you can preempt it and put in place some of the support that they need, they're much more likely to have a positive response to it. But I do think it's a tricky one, because if you think of consumers as also the increasingly effectively polarized partisan people we are talking about, then they're going to have different views, different identity-based views on a lot of social issues. And it's not going to be an easy job for the business to navigate that.
No, and I think what I would add to Laura's many good points there is that actually this is likely to be done to you. And so people have best prepare, because as we become more tribal, and that affects every part of our life, who we work with and who we date and how we live, where we shop, like, it's going to be an issue that crops up on chief execs' radars. And they're going to have to learn how to manage it and respond to it. It's a bit like having to learn how to deal with environmental issues. People used to be able to ignore those 20 years ago, and actually now you really can't get away with that. And it is much better to be prepared and ready to deal with something than to wait for it to hit you,
to think about how to have those conversations ahead of time. I mean, I guess that's the key thing, isn't it?
Exactly. And if you've already modelled behaviour for your workforce or for people that you work with that makes it easier, for example, to say, I don't know, then it is something else that people can pick up and be like, oh, OK, well, I didn't know about this, and I'm going to go and find a bit more about it before I take a position. Or if you'd say, I've changed my mind about an issue, or there's all these things that leaders can do, actually build politically. We've talked about diversity and inclusion. You know, it's well known that it's much easier to bake some of these things in at the start than to retroactively put it in. But if you try and retroactively put it in a crisis, then that's even harder to do. So people should start thinking about it now. And just one rider on that is, although we talk about cognitive and political diversity, I do not think that to use British parlance, a protected characteristic should be your political view. That is very much not the direction of travel that we are heading in. It is not the same as being black and facing systemic racism and things like that. But it is, like, the frame and the way that we discuss diversity, it's helpful to bring that into the room there.
I think so. And I think also to pick up your point at the beginning of that question, Sudha, you know, the companies that responded well after George Floyd's murder were the companies that looked inside their own business, who looked at how do we need to have a conversation about this internally, and what do we need to change, and where are we on our journey, rather than just doing something external, which might be quite hollow. It's that point you made about authenticity. And I think that holds here, doesn't it? It's very different, but at the same time, it's thinking about what you might need to do inside the business before you do something that might activate a particularly partisan consumer. As Ali said, it's not the same, and I don't want to overdraw the parallel, but there is something about businesses who do things well where they focus inside the business first.
Yeah. And if it's not, then actually you can get called out pretty quickly by your employees. And that's pretty awkward and makes leaders even more vulnerable. You know,
and makes comms people very unhappy. Well.
Yeah, I think there's probably like three comms-ish people on this call, and we've all been in a situation where we've had to try and defend something, and we've been like, this is right on the border of like my own integrity and what I'll do and what I'll say, and it makes you really uncomfortable. And it's interesting how few comms people will talk honestly about having been pushed to that point, or where those points are for them, particularly where it's younger and more junior people, and how that can happen. It's very tough, very, very tough. Even then, I've rarely seen people, for example, walk away from accounts if you're in agency land, or decline to re-pitch for something, because they're like, actually, I'm not even just not going to do a good job, but like, this is, I don't like what you're doing from a corporate reputation point of view. Like, it's not good. And in fact, I couldn't do you a good job until this changes. And that's so unusual that you see that. And I think actually there's quite a few comfort people that should think about that a bit more. We're not the judiciary. We don't have a legal responsibility to represent people. We can, if we think we're going to do a bad job, just say no.
Absolutely. I think ethics and comms and what the boundaries are, it's another episode. So we are, I think, listing out quite a few episodes that we need to do after this. Probably when you're talking about polarization and the ability to see it or identify it, you need a group that is non-homogenous. And you surround yourself with people who have the skill sets to do some of what you cannot do. So why is this book relevant now?
Well, take a look out the window, I guess, will be for all three of us. And the reason it's really relevant now is, as I say, generally, we're quite divided at the minute, and all the conditions are that it is going to get worse. And I think a few of these people listening to podcast, they're in comms. They like to influence other people, and maybe they like to think of themselves as a leader. And, you know, we could do something about it. Disaster is not inevitable. But very often the resetting events that come when we become extremely polarized involve violence or famine or, you know, like really bad things we should try and avoid. And the fraying of society, I think, is there. And as Laura touched on, there is a lot of evidence now that political tribalism is driving lots of decisions in other parts of our life. And some political tribalism is healthy and important for a functioning democracy. You don't want to get rid of it. Life will be very boring. But when it's this piece of research that shows political views affect who people hire, and actually they affect to a greater degree than race in terms of influencing those decisions, it affects where you shop. It affects who you live with. People cared about roommate choice more based on political views than they did on if they were clean. It affects how attractive you think someone is and who they will date. All of this stuff means that we are probably spiraling to spending more time with people like us and less time with people who are different to us. And that means polarization is going to get worse. That's why it's really important to look at now and to try and take action to avoid it.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, as Ali said, we've covered so much ground today, actually, haven't we? And there are so many different ways that this has an impact in our lives. And I think because that's only likely to get more intense over the coming years, it's really important that we all understand what that is and what we can do about it. And I think certainly in Poles Apart, we try to make those solutions for all of us as individuals really clear, really to pull out a set of things that everybody can try to do in their lives, in their workplaces, with their families, that can help to bridge some of those divides. So I would say the book is really relevant now and relevant for anybody who wants to make a difference in stemming that tide that Ali was talking about.
Okay, so that was supposed to be my last question, but I want to ask you one more. Polarization is here to stay, and we all should learn more so that we know how to deal and to address or to recognize in our own behaviors what we are doing to encourage it. In this world that we live today, what drives you, or what is that one thing that makes you wake up in the morning and say, yay, looking forward to the day?
I think, as Ali maybe mentioned at the beginning, I think certainly what drove the three of us a lot during this was trying to, and it's going to sound a bit hackneyed, but trying to make a difference on something that's really important. I think that's a huge motivator. If you feel like you can uncover something that might make a big difference for a lot of other people, then it gives you the motivation that you need. And I think probably for all three of us, writing a book alongside full-time jobs and, in Ali's case, having a baby during a pandemic, it's not a thing that's particularly easy to do. And I think what motivated us every day was trying to get it out there into the world, because as I said right at the start, I think there is so much great work on polarization, but certainly in my day-to-day job as a business executive, as a communicator, there was lots of it that I wasn't aware of, that I hadn't seen applied to my line of work, to my world. And I think we really wanted to do something that would be focused enough that it would make really clear what the issue is, but broad enough that people could apply it in lots of different settings. So personally, that's been a big motivator for me.
So I agree with Laura, but I'm going to be wildly unfeminine now. I'm just going to be arrogant. And I'm going to say, because I thought we were good at it, and because I figured we'd be better at it than other people were, because I knew that Laura and Alex were brilliant teammates and that the three of us could probably try and achieve and change things. And I wasn't going to sit down and not do anything or mean that somebody else came along and did it probably less well than I'm arrogant enough to think that the three of us could. And I was like, yeah, we can do this. I like to think that I can try and influence others' behaviour. Laura and Alex, I know they can. And so we set about trying to do so. And I'm not going to take no for an answer. You know?
I think there is definitely something in that. Cedar, we're a fairly relentless trio. I think we could apply that to something that would have a genuine impact and also communicate it well. You know, that was really important, yeah. I think, to all three of us, because so much good work gets done and it doesn't get talked about very much. You know, people struggle to explain the concepts, or, you know, we really wanted to take what we are good at and apply it to a really serious issue.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that actually brought us most joy when we were doing the book, is finding little known bits of research that people have put years of their
research by women.
Actually, we tended to, you know, I'm sure there's all sorts of biases we could pick up there. We tended to probably over-index on finding research by women and by younger women. For the benefit of your listeners, all three of us are under the age of 40. And, you know, like, I'm finding their work and being like, hey, we'd love to feature this. And you could hear the joy in their voice that someone had helped them bridge, you know, Alex maybe, but certainly myself and Laura, you know, we are not hardcore researchers. I don't view success by getting published in Nature or Science, because that's really hard and I'd not be very good at it. But what I am good at is being like, hey, this is how you could apply this to the real world, and this is how you could scale it and bring about change. And actually finding that that was a sweet spot that the three of us could hit to help very clever people help their research bring about change in the world was incredibly gratifying. You know, I hope that your listeners find that when they get the book, that it's got an unusual degree of rigor and applicability for a textbook that's aimed at communicators, actually.
Brilliant. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much, Alison and Laura.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.